Hello and welcome to this episode of the ESG Fitness Podcast. Andy, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm very well, you know. I don't know where that came from.
What the hell was that?
I don't know. It started a little bit Irish and then I just didn't really understand what I was doing. I've had three calls back to back, so sometimes I'm a little bit weird at this point.
Yeah, is this at the point where you start smashing in pre-workout?
I have this can of Lucozade Zero.
Ooh, what flavour is it?
Pink lemonade.
Nice. There's a raspberry ripple Lucozade now that's not sugar-free, unfortunately, but it is unbelievable because raspberries win all the time.
Yeah, they are. They are. Yeah, they are quite good. Raspberries over strawberries.
Oh, 100%. That's not even close.
Right, we got questions.
I do.
Guys, for some reason, I mean, I know why, because this is the biggest intake of Commit 6 we've had, which is very exciting, and I'm so excited to have everyone. But I've literally not been on my laptop or my phone for, I'm going to say, like, at least 72 hours. Like, aside from sleeping.
Oh, wow.
No, not been away. Great life balance, really.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, I mean, worth it. But it has just been... It's been hard, and I think we're moving over to some new software, which is going to be even better, and I think just a much better experience for everyone as well. But obviously, laying the foundation of that is a lot of work. Yes. So there's that involved as well, but all good.
So it's been a busy few days.
It has. And if you're watching and you're like, I'm uncommitted and I've not done my check-in, go and do your check-in, because basically they were sent about an hour late this morning, and my apologies, but please do your check-ins. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a few in that I'm working on at the moment. So all good.
Andy's
all...
just sat there waiting for your check-ins.
I know, twiddling my thumbs. That's some live content right
there. Yeah, guys, if you're listening on the podcast, you're saying this thing out. You guys need to get in there. Okay, we've got a question here. As you're talking about pre-workout, is it a good idea to take it? And what is a reasonable / healthy amount of caffeine in a pre-workout drink? Great question.
Yeah, there's nothing. If it's an over-the-counter pre-workout, absolutely fine. There are under-the-counter pre-workouts, which we do not recommend.
Don't take cocaine.
Yeah, that's also as well. I actually don't know how that would work in a training situation. I don't think you'd get much done. You'd probably be sitting in a corner chewing your face off.
I don't think on cocaine you would, but anyway, moving on.
Yeah. Pre-workout is generally dosed between 150 milligrams of caffeine and probably 500 being at the top end.
In an espresso again? Like 80 grams? Milligrams, sorry.
Milligrams. Whoa. 80 grams, you're going to die.
Milligrams, everyone, just to confirm that.
Yes. I think about between 80 and 100, I think it is. It's not a huge amount. So you're looking at most pre-workouts will be sort of double or treble what an espresso is. Or an espresso, sorry.
An espresso. Yes. So, and also, that varies a lot. So I think Nero is the lowest caffeine content if you're looking at like high street chains. And Costa's is like almost double what Nero's is.
Mad. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a big discrepancy for the what's classed as the same drink.
Yeah, well, you'd think like an espresso is an espresso. Surely the caffeine content would be similar.
Is that due to different coffee beans? Like, I have no idea about coffee and stuff like that, but is it different coffee beans or?
I would imagine so, yeah. Or just how they're brewing. I don't know. Yeah, must be. It must be different coffee beans. So if you want a really big kick, get on down to Costa.
Yeah. But yeah, pre-workout is perfectly safe to take. Don't become reliant on it. It shouldn't be something that you're relying on for a training session. I would say that pre-workout or caffeine isn't going to make your session amazing. It may make a day where you're slightly more tired. If you're working, for instance, training first thing in the morning and you've just woken up, you might want a little bit of energy. Caffeine will give you that little boost.
Oh, actually, Hannah was telling me in check-ins that drinking coffee or consuming caffeine first thing is not a good idea because your adenosine receptors need time to wake up on their own, or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And that actually you should wait, I think it was a couple of hours when you wake up.
Okay.
But I was thinking about that as I was making my morning coffee after just waking up this morning. Still had the coffee. But then I was thinking, I was thinking about that. But I think for me it's so much routine that I could totally have a decaf. So I might go buy some decaf in the morning. Like, it wouldn't, I'm not having it for the kick. I'm just having it because I like sitting down, having a coffee, doing a bit of work. Like, it could be decaf, fine.
Yeah.
And then keep the caffeine for later on.
Yeah, interesting.
But pre-workouts, as Andy's saying, like, I wouldn't rely on them, but there's nothing inherently bad about them. There's nothing inherently bad about caffeine. That most of them are actually underdosed for the ergogenic, i.e. performance enhancing benefits of caffeine. But what else is quite interesting is that most people think that the performance enhancing benefits of caffeine, maybe not most people, but the real benefit probably comes more in endurance type exercise where fat oxidation rates are increased at a slightly higher dosage of caffeine. And that might benefit endurance exercise on like a shorter term period. So on like the benefit in terms of your resistance training workout, you're probably looking more at the effects of being more alert, definitely a placebo effect of like feeling like you have more energy, and then potentially a slight reduction in pain reception. So let's say your RPE was 8, it might only be 7 if you'd had more caffeine, which means you might push yourself that little bit harder.
Yeah.
RPE being a rate of perceived exertion if you haven't done your gym instructor level 2 qualifications.
I'm at 6.17, thank you very much.
How much do you use that in your everyday life as a personal trainer?
I suppose it's the same one as like when you were at school and you never got taught how to do your taxes, which self-employed does help, but you got to learn how to the Pythagoras' theorem.
Oh yeah, I use that all the time. Not a day goes by where I'm not like, I wonder what angle that right angle triangle is.
Yeah, I wonder what y equals 6 and x is a banana. Fuck knows, no idea. Yeah,
maybe I don't know, when you actually start to figure out taxes and inflation and everything, it's not that, like, it's maybe just a bit much for a child to realize how much they're going to be. Many questions come up. Maybe it's too political for a maths lesson. Okay, it's worth joining just to hear you two chatting away. Oh, that's cute. My goal is building muscle. Should I be aiming for more than 3 workouts per week? And does it matter if I'm struggling to hit the 10,000 steps a day, I can get around 7,000? Okay. So, first of all, we're very glad you're here. Secondly, 3 or 4 workouts a week to build muscle is ample. If if you really enjoy working out and you want to do 5 workouts a week, great. But what you don't want to do is start training to a point that you can't optimally recover from. And remember that the building of the muscle actually happens outside of your workout. You're working out to create a stimulus, and the recovery period is so important. So often, actually, especially for clients who are looking to get very lean, I'll actually dial back the number of workouts they have when they move into like a hypertrophy phase, because you're looking more at optimizing recovery there. And does it matter that you're not getting 12,000 steps a day? If fat loss isn't your goal, no, not necessarily. I would like you, this is just me being very picky, to go up to 7,500 steps per day, because that seems to be, from the research, the level at which you're getting the most benefit in terms of your health and reduced mortality risk from the first 7,500 steps you do per day. And then over and above that, like, you still get benefits, but they aren't as linked to your health. They're more about, I guess, increased energy expenditure. So if you can get 7,500, I'd be very happy. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, okay. Alison's question. I did answer this in the thing, but we'll go over it anyway. Hi, I had a question about protein supplements and the difference between whey protein and creatine. I've taken whey protein for a few years, adding to oats for breakfast, etc. I was wondering whether to start on creatine too. Does it have different benefits? Is there much difference between powder creatine versus tablet format other than the need to scoop? Thank you so much.
The need to scoop.
The simple answer on this one is that whey protein and creatine are two completely different supplements. Whey protein is a supplement that's very handy for helping increase your protein intake, which many people struggle with when they start looking at tracking calories and tracking their macros, etc. Protein's always a tough one to get. Best ways to do it are increasing portion sizes at main meals. So rather than a chicken breast, have a chicken breast and a half. Little simple things like that, but supplementation of protein is quite a handy way of looking at things, especially if things like on the run, protein shakes, protein bars, etc. Creatine is a supplement that's the most researched supplement on the market. It's very good for helping aid muscle building, endurance, power, cognitive function, and it's creatine monohydrate. Doesn't matter if it's tablet form or powder form, 3 to 5 grams per day for life is the best way to put it.
Well, I've got nothing to add.
Yeah, nice and simple. It's but like, see, like, little questions like that are the kind of stuff that, you know, you are great question. They're just really simple questions, and it's something that, you know, something like that that pops up, you know, whether it's on our social media channels or whether it's in the group, ping them up. Like, they're stuff that, although we take the piss and sort of say about creating questions, if you genuinely have a question about them, fire them up. It's just stuff that's just really simple, that's really simple answers.
Yeah, excellent question. I think it's easy to forget that, like, for a lot of people, so much of this is new, especially when we've been doing it for so long, and some of our clients have been doing it for so long, but there are no stupid questions, and everyone starts somewhere. Everyone has to learn these things. And so I think that, like, a note, because I know a lot of personal trainers listen to this as well, but, like, a note to personal trainers and other people putting out content is, like, don't think that people know what you think they know. So, for example, I had three conversations this week, all of which people were still using their BMR and trying to take calories from their BMR, so their basal metabolic rate. So how many calories you need just to stay alive. They were trying to create a deficit from those calories. Now, obviously, that gives you ridiculously low calories that no one can stick to, and they weren't getting results because they can't stick to those calories. But it just, and it was genuine, like, oh, well, I did this calculator and it came out saying this was my calories, so I took calories from that. And you're like, okay, there's still really simple information that needs to be put across, which is what's, like, holding a lot of people back. So yeah, never think like, oh, you know, everyone must know this stuff already. Don't need to talk about calories again, or someone else has spoken about calories. The basics explained well are so, so useful to so many people. So keep doing it.
I think you're right. I think as well, something that I notice, and that is obviously between the two of us, we've got a whack of experience in the fitness industry and a whack of years in the industry. But the one thing I notice with personal trainers, and it's depending on what gym you go into, well, it doesn't matter what gym you go into, actually, is the level that you talk at your client. Like, that's one thing I think what we get right at all times is the level that you're speaking. Like, you do not, as a personal trainer, I shouldn't be doing content that's aimed at people like you. Like, you know the shit, like, you know what's happening. People who, you need to aim your content at your clients, and that's what you need to do. You need to be able to understand it. And remember, one of the first times I went into a pure gym, I was listening to a personal trainer, like, honestly, talking about mTOR, GLUT4, all this kind of stuff. And I'm just sitting going, I'm bamboozled. And the client was sitting looking at them, go as if to say, I've genuinely, and like, you straight away, that person was never coming back to the gym. Never, ever. They'll never set foot in that gym again because they have no fucking clue what's going on.
Well, it shows that you really understand something when you can be, when you can understand the mTOR pathway, but then understand how that relates to muscle protein synthesis, and then understand how that might relate to building muscle, and then understand what a client needs to know and what they don't need to overcomplicate. And I think that, like, is one of the skills of coaching. And the reason that we get it right is because we spend so much time talking to our clients. So, like, basically, we're listening to your questions. So we know what you need to know, what you want to know, what your concerns are. Like, that's why our content is relevant, because it comes directly from the people that we want to help. Like, that's as simple as it needs to be. But you're right. I think a lot of personal trainers, especially on social media, almost want to be seen as, like, the smartest, or think that that's important, or think that it's important that, for example, I found Andy's post really useful. That's not important. I'm not, well, actually, I am his client. But you know what I mean? Like, in most situations, like...
That's not the point.
Yeah, Andy is actually my coach, but that was a very bad example. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm not target audience, right?
No.
So think about that when you're putting out content. Right, I've got a question here. Does working out first thing fasted make you disproportionately hungrier later in the day? That was a very strange noise.
I know, I was kind of... Suddenly I've got my something chapped in a door somewhere. It can do. I'm guessing if you are... It depends on when you eat afterwards, though. Like, it depends on when you eat afterwards, depends on your choices in food volume. So if you have a protein shake just, and that's the only thing that you've had until later on in the day, you might find that you're disproportionately hungry because you've got no food volume in your stomach. It can do. It just depends on how you situate your meals after that.
It's very individual as well. So exercise can actually make some people hungrier and some people less hungry. There's huge... individual variability there, and you know, the research again kind of confirms that on average certain things might happen, but then you look at, this is what's quite important about being able to read and interpret research as well, that if you look at the actual data and it shows that, I don't know, one person's hunger went massively up and one person's hunger went massively down, if you take the average of that, means nothing's happened when actually a huge amount has happened on either side. So this is why, like, being research-led and understanding the research is important, but the art of coaching is applying that. So research is going to tell you what happens on average for most people, or maybe not even for most people. It's just going to tell you what happens on average, but that doesn't tell you what's happening for an individual. So if you find that exercising fasted in the morning makes you way hungrier, then we work around that. Even if we don't have the science to say exactly why that would happen.
Yeah.
So if that's what you're finding, then maybe fasted cardio is not a great idea for you.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, look, from Jenny. Hi, I have a question around low-calorie foods, which I think is really just me needing to get comfortable with eating them again, if that's a good thing and will help me reach my goals. As a serial dieter, I've done Slimming World in the past, but more recently the 5-2 fasting Mediterranean approach and a different diet along similar lines where the focus is on olive oil, full fat yogurts, etc., but in smaller quantities. I think I'm probably confused between healthy fats. Is olive oil good? But low-cal fry light spray would be help reduce calories. Maybe full fat Greek yogurt as a protein source. But if you just wanted a yogurt snack, you should go low calorie. Any guidance appreciated. Just finding it hard to get my head around the change in mindset of the past few years of not choosing low calorie options because I didn't think they were good for me. Low fat rather than low calorie. I thought the point was that low fat food had a load of sweeteners or other things that weren't good for you. Sorry, one confused victim of diet culture.
This number is such one, a good question.
Don't apologize.
Yeah, don't apologize, but fantastic question. And I can see where you're coming from. And actually, if I'm totally honest, if there was one diet that I thought was the healthiest, it would be the Mediterranean diet. Like, if I was going to put my hat in one corner. I think where you have to make some... what's the right word? Basically, balance is important as well. And enjoying food is important as well. And I think when it comes to fats, the approach I take is to choose the ones I'm going to enjoy most and go full fat on those. So if I'm like, full fat Greek yogurt gives me life. Like, it is so enjoyable, so tasty. Like, that's where I'm going for my full fat. If I'm like, I don't know, having a salad and I'm like, having olive oil on a salad with like fresh tomatoes is amazing. Great olive oil. And actually, massive fan of olive oil. I think that if there was a health food or a superfood, like, it would probably be olive oil. So having some of that in your diet, great. But if I'm cooking a stir fry, do I notice if I'm having olive oil or fry light? No. And actually, some of the benefits might be reduced when you're heating olive oil. So I would prefer that you had it cold anyway. So it's just like making these little choices, like, okay, does adding an extra 150 calories to my stir fry because I've used olive oil, which I can't even really tell the difference between the spray, which is what, 3 or 4 calories, and the olive oil, which is 100, depending on how much of it you're using. No. So on that option, I'm not going to choose the high fat. But having some high fat foods in your diet not only is really enjoyable, really tasty, but also really good for health. So I think what you're asking is like, is one good or the other? There's a balance between the two, and you might want to utilize both. You might want to be like, yeah, when I have a salad, I'll have some olive oil on it, but when I cook, I'm just going to use fry light.
Yeah, perfect. And I think the exactly as Jenny mentioned about the whole diet culture thing, is things like people, you know, we had a massive thing. I don't know if it's such a big thing anymore, but everybody talking about sweeteners being toxic and poisonous and stuff. The research doesn't show that whatsoever. There's a toxic level to a sweetener, but you'll drown from the amount of fluid that you need to intake to get the amount of Diet Coke to poison you, pretty much. You're looking at like something like 400 liters of Coke before it becomes
and I think it was
toxic.
It's 32 liters until you reach like the upper limit, that's like the RDA upper limit or something of aspartame. But then if you wanted to actually cause toxicity, it was like even more than that. But it's just completely unrealistic. And actually, a small amount of those things is fine. Your body can deal with that.
Exactly. And that's it. But it's a good, again, another really good question, and another one that a lot of people get really stuck on, because, you know, you can say it's, I always look at it, I always call it the healthy food conundrum, where you can set up two diets that are both exactly, that both have the same goal, whether it be fat loss or muscle building, and you can populate one fully with what people would class as horrific, like foods that you shouldn't be eating if you're trying to lose fat, but you could populate it with that. As long as the calories still put you into a calorie deficit, you're laughing. But I think this thing where people seem to struggle with is getting their head around that stuff, where this is what we try to do, is we try to promote flexibility within your diet so that you can actually enjoy foods that you like exactly like that. You know, you can have olive oil in your salad, but making these little swaps for, you know, potentially cooking meat or stir fries, whatever it is, with a low calorie spray is going to give you that little bit extra leeway on calories, which is pretty much what we're after, is, you know, it's a calorie balance of getting into your deficit. And I think getting that round into your head is it does take a little bit of time. And again, questions like this are really good to be able to start to sort of siphon through and be able to understand it. So yeah,
I think it's hard because neither side of that is good. Like, just eating processed foods which have been designed to be lower in calories, I wouldn't suggest that. But just eating high fat foods is going to make it really quite hard for you to stick to your calories and create a deficit and lose body fat. And if you need to lose body fat to improve your health, then actually eating the quote unquote healthier diet might not be the best option for you if it means that you're going way over your calories. So there's that like little balance in the middle that usually is the answer to these things.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, do you care?
The other thing that is interesting on that point is, just as you were talking, I was like, I think you can actually do a hell of a lot, like, quote unquote, wrong with your diet, and yet still probably get quite decent results if you're resistance training. So I was just thinking, like, how poor do you think someone's results would be if they basically just ate quote unquote like junk food, let's say relatively low protein, maybe they were only getting in like 60 grams a day, but they were resistance training and their calories were on point, I actually think they'd probably do fairly well. Now, would it be enjoyable to stick to that? No. Would it be beneficial to your health? Like, probably not. But yeah, I just think building muscle is so much to do with the training stimulus.
I think a lot of it as well is about, remember, there's that age old one, you can't out-train a bad diet. You probably can.
You can.
And I would suggest that it's just most people do.
Oh no, I would suggest that most people don't. That's the problem. No? Like, I think when most people say that, they're not talking about like building muscle, they're talking about body fat, right? So most people aren't gonna out-train their poor diet. In fact, their watch is gonna tell them that they burnt twice as many calories as they have, and then they're gonna think, oh, I can eat more because of that. So most of the time that doesn't happen. But like, good examples of this is if you look at Tour de France athletes and stuff, of course you can out-train a like quote-unquote bad diet. And when most people say bad diet, they just mean high calories, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're expending a shit ton of calories, but most of us work on a computer, maybe just about hit our 10,000 steps a day. If we're making an effort, we get in those 12,000 steps. But we don't expend much energy in comparison to like elite-level athletes.
Yeah. Which is why I think I always find it a dangerous one when people start using calories as or calories burned as a way to look at your training, you know, because you don't actually burn that many calories in a training session. It's the extras alongside it that are the, you know, the building of muscle, the sort of all the things that come along with the resistance training is what you should be looking at, not the, oh, I burned 700 calories in that leg session. Well, you probably didn't because your tracker's talking shit. And it's not about burning calories. It's not a good relationship to build with training and with food.
Yeah. Yes. And actually, if we wanted you to just burn as many calories as possible, I would have set all of your workouts to some kind of moderate intensity cardio for an hour. Like, that's probably what's going to burn the most calories. Whatever intensity you can maintain for about an hour, that's what's going to burn the most calories. That isn't why we're exercising. Exercising, like, most people's goals on Commit Six are body composition related. Yeah. Whether that's building muscle or losing fat or a combination of the both, that's what your workouts are programmed for. And that's what your diet is programmed for. But your training is more about stimulating muscle than it is about burning any calories. You do that out with your workouts. You do that living your life, being active, eating in accordance to your energy demands. That's how you lose body fat.
Yeah.
Okay, question here. Fat loss is amongst my ever-growing goals. I did chat to Catherine about my steps. She was lovely about it. I average 8,000 to 10,000 steps a day, but this is down to ability, dodgy injuries, not because of time or because I can't be asked. I am swimming as well as doing the workouts. Will swimming supplement the steps for fat loss? I am quite good at it. Obviously, I'm no Adam Peaty, but I can dream. Or will my calories need to be reduced? Also, should I be swimming on my rest days or after the gym? Thanks. Swim whenever you want. And yeah, that sounds perfect. That sounds really good, actually. It's not, your steps aren't particularly low anyway. And if you're doing extra cardio via swimming, sounds like you're nailing it.
Exactly.
I am nearly 8 weeks post I'm just going to say hysterectomy because there's a word that I can't pronounce. Recovering well and have been discharged by the consultant. Was relatively fit before, but not done any exercise other than walking since the op. Are there any exercises I should be avoiding right now? We'll be using light weights initially, but not sure if ab work is a step too far at the moment. Yeah, I would be quite careful with that. I'm surprised and a little bit sad that the GP hasn't, or not the GP, your surgeon hasn't given you like more of a guidance as to exactly anything that you should be avoiding. I don't know if you could contact them, just be like, I'm going to be exercising again, aside from just slowly increasing the amount that I do, is there anything specifically I should be avoiding?
Yeah.
I'm assuming because the word I can't say is laparoscopic, which I can say. Nailed it.
Do you not get with something like that? Do you not get put in touch with the physios for?
I mean, Andy, I paid a fortune for my back, and they gave me a really old PowerPoint which had a picture of someone sitting in a certain position and said, like, this is how you should sit. And and then the man told me not to do any boxing for 8 weeks.
That's right, I remember that. Don't do any boxing. Okay.
My mum's face was like she was clearly trying to angle him to be like, don't do any exercise, so that I wouldn't I would rush back.
Definitely get back in touch with the surgeon and potentially ask for a referral to the physio.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple of women who have had hysterectomies, and aside from slowly getting back to it, like, I think you should probably be fine. It can sometimes feel quite strange, as in, like, there's more space there, because obviously there is. Rehysterectomy, physio, not much use really, just said build up gradually. Oh, great. How helpful.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Great. Yeah, I would not do any movement, certainly alongside like things like crunching movements. You're probably going to want to stay away from that to start off with. Potentially doing a little bit of like maybe not even isometric stuff, actually, depending on how far through, how long. Was it 8 weeks since?
8 weeks, yeah.
Would
do you know
just,
what? Just to ease yourself in and you'll probably be fine. Yeah. But I would just wouldn't really do things that are going to put too much pressure.
Yeah. Pressure through it, definitely.
But definitely best to start slower than anything else. And then we can build up.
100%.
How efficient does your body get used to exercise when exercising regularly, but don't change it much? For example, 3 spin classes, 3 boot camps, which comprise of body weight, kettlebells, dumbbell circuits, but not lifting particularly heavy, just slowing movements down to make it harder. Doing this sort of routine for nearly 2 years, therefore, does it make losing weight harder, or just the fact that my eating hasn't been consistent at 1600 calories and more indulgent over the weekends, so not in a calorie deficit, or am I overthinking stuff? Sorry. Again, excellent question, but this kind of comes back to what we were just discussing, which is exercise isn't the primary factor for fat loss. So there are 2 things here. One, you have kind of nailed it. Like, the fitter you are, the less calories you will burn for a given amount of exercise. So your spin class, when you were less fit, would have been, like, let's say the intensity was the same, would have been easier for you. Sorry, would have been harder for you when you were less fit. But if you're doing the exact same class at the exact same intensity, now that you're fitter, that's going to burn less calories because it's an easier intensity for you. If you've been like, as I get fitter, I'm cranking up the resistance, then that should have less of an effect. Same kind of thing with the boot camps. But how that impacts fat loss, pretty negligible. What's definitely going to be more of a consideration is that you've not been consistent with your calories and then overeating on the weekends. So I wouldn't worry so much about the exercise side.
Yeah. The exercise side of stuff is obviously body composition. If you want to start pushing that a bit harder, you're probably going to have to stimulate it a bit harder with resistance sessions. Boot camps, we had a few questions about things like people wanting to change body composition in certain types of training. The issue that you have with certain types of training is that they're not stimulating in a manner that's going to be optimal for building body composition. So something like a boot camp isn't going to help you build muscle, but it's probably going to be a slightly slower ebb than if you were actually focusing on a resistance session. So these kind of little things that they tie hand in hand, they're great to do, they're great to keep you ticking over, and if you enjoy them. I think somebody asked me about that with classes and body composition. Yep, classes will help you tick over if you enjoy them. I would say not to drop them out, but if body composition is your main goal, you're probably going to have to switch out a class for a resistance session in the gym, working with weights. That's the more optimal way forward for it.
Yeah, now and again we have conversations with people that are like, I really want to build muscle, but I'm just going to do five Les Mills classes a week or something. And it's like, okay, but that's not conducive to your goal of building muscle.
Yeah.
And at some point you maybe just have to take a step back and look at the perspective, like, what do I want? What's my end goal? And how do I want to get there? Now, we're not saying that if you enjoy classes, you can't do classes.
Yeah. But
are your actions in line with your goals?
Yeah.
And if they're not, then either accept that you're not going to reach your goal doing that or change your actions.
Exactly.
Okay, I've got some more here. Shall I go? Here. Is there a difference when it comes to reps/weight? Is doing 20 reps at 10 kilograms the same as doing 10 reps at 20 kilograms? Or is the larger reps better for endurance and lower reps better for strength? Or is it all just rubbish and it's all the same? Also, where would you, if you would, fit interval training within fat loss? Okay, so start of this question. It depends on your goal. So if hypertrophy is your goal, actually doesn't seem to matter if you do 20 reps at 10 kilograms or 10 reps at 20 kilograms.
Yep.
The reason that there is a quote-unquote hypertrophy rep range is because the biggest driver of hypertrophy is how much total volume you can create. So in your example, the total volume is the same because it's either 20 times 10 or it's 10 times 20. So the outcome, the total volume, is the same. As you get to like heavier weights and things, it just becomes easier to create the most volume at about an 8 to 15-ish rep range. That just seems to be where it's easiest to create the most volume because you can lift moderately heavy weights for that rep range. And you're right, at either end of the extreme, if you were doing like 3 rep maxes, that's going to be optimal for building strength. If you were doing like 50 reps, that's more like muscular endurance type exercise. So there will be some slightly opposing adaptations there as well. And strength is not exactly the same as hypertrophy. So yeah. Interval training in regards to fat loss, again, we've kind of just been talking about this. Like, exercise isn't what's going to push you towards fat loss. Interval training isn't particularly useful for fat loss. It will obviously burn some calories, probably less than moderate intensity cardio. But again, there are so many benefits to interval training, especially in terms of your metabolic health, that there might be other reasons that you're doing that, not specifically in line with fat loss. If you wanted to fit that in your week, fine. Make sure you're doing 3 of our workouts if you have a body composition goal. And then if you want to do it another day, do some interval training another day. Great.
Sorted.
Okay. Getting the shakes in the middle of an exercise set, particularly tempo work, can carry on for the remaining 5 to 6 reps, but unsure if the shakes are poor form, no pain, do I need to work lighter? No.
Sounds like you're working at the perfect level. The shakes is generally, well, when you're a newbie, the shakes is normally your muscles trying to work out the order of how they should go in to move the weight. But even now, 30 years of training coming up, probably started training properly when I was about 9 or 10. I still get the shakes when I'm working at a maximal weight. You'll still get trying to force a weight and it's like juddering its way through, provided the technique stays good, exactly as you said, and there's no pain. Fire on, that's fine, absolutely fine.
How important is rest time between sets? 1 to 2 minutes feels a long time sat on a bench in the gym. Should I be doing something in that time? We want you to lift as heavy as possible. So you'll notice that the rest periods, like, I'm not as fussed about them for some exercises. So you'll normally start with like the fundamental, like a compound exercise. And for that, where I want you to lift as heavy as possible with good form, I want you to have decent breaks. Because otherwise it's going to impact either your form or the amount of weight that you can lift. If you're doing like some kind of, if I put in some kind of superset of like bicep curls and kickbacks or something, I don't really care if you take shorter breaks, but they're normally programmed in a bit shorter as well anyway. But yeah, for your strength work, which tends to be at the start of your sessions, yes, please take that break.
Exactly.
Okay, we're good on the live.
Right. Matilda, thanks for all the support so far. This is really just asking for some advice. Any advice on how to deal with naturally slim family members, in brackets, the mother-in-law, who constantly makes comments like, aren't you having any cake? Aren't you having any toast with lashings of jam and butter? It really angers me and I feel like saying, actually, I'm trying to make choices that align with my goals of fat loss and strength, but that is not possible. Nor do I want to share my journey with her, because she wouldn't get it, as she would not be supportive.
Yeah, honestly, my approach would just be keep it to yourself. Like, just be like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, it's frustrating, and but equally you said you don't want to share your journey with her. If it was someone else, I might say something like, you know, if it was your mum and you maybe had a closer relationship with them, obviously projecting here now, but you might say, look, this is important to me at the moment and I'm working really hard on my weight loss, and actually you offering me toast five times with loads of, you know, like, it's not helpful to me at the moment. I really appreciate your support because it's important to me. If you don't want to do that, then I would just keep being like, no, thank you.
Or if it's a mother-in-law, go fuck yourself, works nicely.
I mean, like, not everyone's going to support your goals, and you don't need everyone to support your goals. If you've got like a couple of people, I mean, you've got a whole group of people supporting your goals. You've got four coaches backing you to get the best results. So you don't need your mother-in-law to support your goals. And I get that it's hard because it's almost like sabotage, isn't it? Like, oh, do you want some cake? Do you want some more? Why aren't you having any cake? But you just have to be strong and stick to your guns on that.
Yeah, I think it's judging the situation, isn't it? Some people, it's just not worth bringing the thing up. For other people, it's depends on you as a person as well. If you're the kind of person that doesn't like confrontation, don't go with it. If it's something that it's really pissing you off, you might want to just turn in and say, look, this is what I'm doing. I'm not expecting any support. We're not going to talk about it anymore.
Do you think there are people that do like confrontation?
That's like me. I prefer to get it out in there. If you do like confrontation, go after it.
Yeah. I think it depends who it is, doesn't it? Like, and what they mean to you. Like, I sometimes think this, like, if a friend has annoyed me, but to be honest, their friendship's like, not, like, I don't want to fix the friendship. I don't value it as much as other friendships. I just won't bring it up. I'll be like, that was a bit annoying, but I'm not going to bring it up. Whereas if it was someone else, like if it was Andy, I'd be like, that really upset me. And then
what did I do?
Talk about it and then we'd move on. I know, you've never done anything wrong. But, you know, like sometimes it's worth having the discussion. It's worth having the argument. And other times it's like, I kind of knew that's what you were like anyway. And going forward, I'll just know.
100%. You'll know the people that you can that you need to have the uncomfortable conversations with. And sometimes you need to have the uncomfortable conversations. It's the same as being a coach. Sometimes it's the same thing. We talk about this regularly, that people are like, oh, I want tough love. It's the people that normally were wanting tough love are the people that need that arm around their shoulder and empathy. And also we discussed this in a couple podcasts ago, that the tough love is very much dependent on your level of confidence as a person. If you're extremely confident in yourself, tough love can work and probably will work. If you're not confident in yourself, tough love probably isn't going to work and it's probably going to be non-conducive to your goal.
I'm back.
You're back. Welcome back.
I got a delivery, but it was very... it was like very aggressive knocking.
Oh, was it?
I thought, oh my God.
I've got a parcel for you. Yeah. Wait, what's in your door?
I was like, jeez. I wonder what it is.
I bet. Oh, imagine.
Do you know what it is? I found shoes that I like, and now I've bought them in every single different colour.
I thought you were going to tell me it's like another infrared sauna that you can have in your... Ooh, they're swanky.
But also have them in black.
Oh, I like the blue ones. They're cool.
Yeah, yeah. I'm here for it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be great if you could run.
I mean, yeah, can't run. But at least I have all the gear. At least
blue
I'm like,
would make
oh,
you look so fast.
New Balance. Yeah, I'm a runner. Shh. What?
Hell yeah.
Okay.
You put in one. You should now. You can mix and match. You can have one blue one and one black one.
Do you think I'd get away with that? Do you think got like enough street creds to do that?
Fucking own it. Just do it.
Andy, I'm going to do
black, one blue. Call it. Why? Because I'm Emma and I can do what the hell I want.
Yeah. Yeah, rocking I could do
it.
That.
Rocking it.
Okay, right. On back with to, the back, life.
Back to questions. From Bex, more of a fun than useful question. You mentioned a few lives ago that it would be good to try and arrange a get-together of all the members. Let's do this.
Yes.
I get the feeling most all of you coaches live around Edinburgh? I'm so up for a trip to Edinburgh. Shona's Glasgow. Catherine's Stirling.
Yeah, but Edinburgh's pretty central and pretty obviously central. The best. Yeah. And Hannah lives in Edinburgh.
Yeah, it's obviously easy for me because I live in Edinburgh. Yeah. That's always a bonus.
Yeah, okay. We will do this. We will.
It's written in the stars.
You've said it on the podcast now, so it has to happen.
Just quickly to say, thanks already for genuinely helping change my life. I've only been listening to the podcast, etc., for a month or so, but my mindset is already a million times better in many aspects of my life, as well as food. Your advice even helped me solve a major family issue surrounding my wedding that I'd been upset for over for so long. Thanks, guys.
Aww.
That's cute.
Feel a warm and fuzzy.
Yes. Okie dokie. From Olivia. I'm really good at not buying junky snack food, chocolate biscuits, etc. So whenever I have any in the house, which makes adherence relatively straightforward. If you don't buy it, you can't eat it, right? However, if I do end up with anything like this in the house for any reason, I brought snacks for the babysitter, and there's some left over, or if I go to someone else's house and that kind of thing is available and offered to me, I cave. I've been this way as long as I can remember. What is the main principle I need to tackle in order to get over this? I can't ever imagine being able to enjoy that kind of food in moderation, so it's just much easier not to have it at all.
Yeah, I mean, balance is hard. Moderation is hard. It's actually way, way harder than just saying no. So what you're doing at the moment is kind of avoiding the problem, which works to an extent. Until the problem is like in your house and then you can't not eat the biscuits that you have. So the best way I think to do this is like exposure, basically. You need to start proving to yourself that you can have a pack of biscuits in your house and not eat them. And this may seem like an odd thing to celebrate and to test yourself with, but go and buy a packet of biscuits, put them in your cupboard. And this week, try and have one every night and not eat the rest. Like, that would be a huge win. And then, instead of just thinking, because this is what we often do, like, that might happen on occasion where you do just have one. But you think, well, that's normal behavior. That should be normal behavior. So I'm not going to celebrate that as a win. But that's a massive win for you. Like, if you've had an all or nothing mentality your whole life and you're managing to practice moderation, you need to start celebrating that as a big win. Because otherwise, like, you're only celebrating, you're only like beating yourself up about the negative. When you eat the full packet, you're like beating yourself up about it. But yet when you do, on the occasion that you do have one, you're not giving yourself any credit for it. So like, here's your goal this week. Try and do that this week. Go and buy a packet of biscuits. Try and have one or two a night and make sure that you've still got the packet of biscuits by the end of the week. That's a massive win.
Yeah. And exactly as you said, it's like, this is the whole, everything is about learning. Habits don't just happen off the cuff. You have to learn them. You have to implement them. You have to reiterate them, keep going and keep building them. And this is exactly the same thing. You know, you need to build the trust in yourself that you can have something in the cupboard and not go mental with it. You know, that's genuinely something that I'm pretty good at. My fiance Laura, on the other hand, fucking awful at it. If there's a pack of chocolate in there, it's gone within 10 minutes. But I can have a pack of chocolate in the cupboard for 6 months and I open up and I'm like, still there, perfect, shut the door. But you know, it's something that you've kind of got to use a bit of willpower on. You know, none of this is going to be easy. It's going to be slight, things are going to be tough, but things that are tough, as we've mentioned, are generally the things that are worth it. So is it worth, do you want to be able to have that inability to have a biscuit in your diet and not freak out when something like that comes up? that's, I'd say that that's something that's more than worthwhile having in your life. So being able to do that is very important. So having this little challenge for yourself is going to step it up and show you that you can actually do this.
Yeah, it allows you to enjoy food, because you don't, like, yeah, you don't enjoy it when you eat the full packet and then you feel guilty about it and then you beat yourself up about it. But it is enjoyable to sit down at the end of the day and have a cup of tea and have a couple of biscuits. And, like, we want that enjoyment for you, and we don't want that food to have any control over you. And the thing is, it's not, and when you really sit down and think about it, it's not an inability problem. Like, you can absolutely do that. You are completely capable of doing that. You just need to prove to yourself that you can. And it's more the story that you're telling yourself, because you're telling yourself now, like, I've been like that my whole life. And the more and more you reinforce that story by, yeah, okay, I did eat a full pack of biscuits that time, and I did do it that time, and I did, and then you're like, oh, see, that is just me. That's just who I am. That's just what I do. And then that becomes really hard to break. So you need to, first of all, like, the language you're using, like, stop telling yourself this is who you are and this is what you've always done, and start realizing that's changeable. And that's something that you used to do, and that's not something that you do now, and it's not something about you. It's just an action. It's just a behaviour.
Yeah, exactly. Okie dokie, Lisa. It's quite a big question. Hi, guys. What a fun packed week we've had so far. I'm being sarcastic. I hurt like fuck, but in a good way. She put 4 stars, so I just decided to put that word in. Could have been anything.
Could have been anything, yeah.
Sounded like it suited the sentence. A bit of a long one here. I've been in a calorie deficit and a committed tracker since mid-May, when I started to make a concerted effort to lose weight, regain health and fitness. The ongoing trend has been downward, and I've lost 1 stone and 10 pounds since that time, which is great. But since I had COVID last month, nothing, no movement, nit, nada, zilch for about 4 weeks. The longest I've gone without a loss. I understand that I had an overload of histamine in my body, along with inflammation of my joints, which caused associated pain, but I don't understand why the downtrend has stopped. Would that impact on it? Yes, I have been tracking rigidly and erring on the side of caution. I've remained in a deficit. My exercise did effectively ground down to a bit of a crawl when I had the virus, but I picked it up and joined the gym in preparation for committing to six. As soon as I was allowed back out again. So I don't think that would have made a difference, or would it? I saw that a couple of the guys were weighing themselves every day to track trends, so I thought I'd try it. Big mistake, the scale shows a different weight every day, which I know is not a true indication of fat lost or gained. Yesterday it said I'd put 5 pounds since the previous day. Obviously that's bollocks. I don't know if this is related to COVID or not. It just seems a bit disheartening. I know you're not doctors, but do you have any thoughts on this?
Okay, the reason it's disheartening is because you think, or you're telling yourself, that fat loss is measured on the scales. It's not. The reason that we get people to track every day is exactly as you've said. It cannot be fat loss. Then you kind of take the pressure off it, because you're like, oh my God, it fluctuates by this much every day. Like, of course it's not fat loss. If you're saying you're getting big fluctuations, but you've only been weighing yourself once a week, who's to say you weren't catching yourself at a higher fluctuation? And that's why you've not lost weight in the last 4 weeks. The likelihood is that during COVID, you reduced your activity levels, you reduced your exercise, as we would hope that you would. That might mean that you were in a slightly smaller deficit, if you were in a deficit at all. So fat loss might have slowed a little bit during that time. I'm willing to bet that if you're sticking to your calories, you're doing your exercise, you're hitting your steps, you are losing fat now. It's not showed on the scales yet, which is totally normal. And the less fat that you have to lose, because initially you will have had more fat to lose and you've lost a decent amount of weight, which is incredible, but you have to be realistic that that rate of weight loss is going to slow, because you simply have less to lose. So there's a couple of things there, but I wouldn't change anything. I think you're disheartened because you're putting too much emphasis on the scales. Yeah. And it will happen. Like, they will drop again. It's just, we don't know if that'll be tomorrow or if that'll be next week. But you're doing all the right things. You are losing body fat. It's just not showed yet.
Yeah. Just the big one is keep ticking the boxes. As long as you're ticking your boxes and you're staying consistent, that's the big one. And again, as Emma mentioned, take the pressure off. Stop looking at the scales as a badge of progress. It's not. There are many other. It's a very, very useful tool to help see where you're at. But if you are putting so much emphasis on it, if things don't go well, you're always going to throw yourself off. Like if you hang your hat on, say for instance, you get all these kind of internet gurus who hang their hat on one type of diet. As soon as that's disproven, that's them. That's their world's ended. Everything's shot out the window. You're doing the same at the moment with your weight. You're hanging your hat on a weight, and that's putting you off. Don't let it do that. You've seen the fluctuations on the scale. Realize that fluctuations in the scale daily is what's happening. So take the pressure off. Stop looking at the scale as something that makes or breaks your day. And I know that's easy for me to say, harder to put it into practice, but try to look at it that way.
Yeah, and the reason that we will continue to talk so much about the scales is it really is what holds a lot of people back, their reaction to that. So you might quite easily, I mean, it sounds like you haven't, and that's excellent, but you might quite easily look at the scales not going down for 2 weeks when you were used to seeing it trend down and think, it's not working anymore, I'm just going to give up. Or it's not working anymore, I'm going to massively cut my calories. Both of which end in poor adherence or overeating at some point. Or just increasing calories. And that misunderstanding of the scale weight is genuinely why a lot of people never lose fat. And that's why we keep talking about it so frequently. And often all you need is a bit of reassurance, and hopefully that's what you've got from us right now. But that's why we keep talking about it. That's why we keep reiterating it, because sometimes you just need a bit of reassurance, enough that you'll keep on track for another week, and then bam, the scales drop again.
That's it, exactly. Right.
Last question.
Linda. Hi, guys. As it's frowned upon to punch people in the face or burst into tears in public, I tend to turn to food. Any tips for emotional eating? When's it been frowned upon to punch people in the face?
What?
I've never heard of that one.
She obviously doesn't live in Scotland, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's just a general occurrence. It's how you greet people.
It's hard for me to walk down the street without getting punched in the face, actually. It's a very annoying face. Journal. Write down your feelings. I mean, even punching isn't going to help. If that was all you needed, then just go to the gym, take it out at the gym. But really, writing down your feelings instead of finding another coping mechanism aside from food. Sure, it's fine to have various coping mechanisms, but sometimes you're just moving from one thing to another, all in an attempt to avoid actually feeling your feelings and actually asking why you're feeling them and what that means and exploring that a little bit. That's kind of what you're avoiding. And the best thing to do is just face that. And I mean, we all do it a little bit to an extent. And it tends to be why you tend to emotionally eat in the evening, because you're really busy all day and you stay busy all day, which means you don't really have time to think about anything. And then by the time the evening comes, you're like, oh God, I have all these feelings that I've effectively been running away from all day. Now I end up overeating because I don't want to think about those things. I want to concentrate on something else. So really the best thing to do, in my opinion, would be to go to therapy. That's quite expensive for most people if you don't need it on the NHS. The second best thing is journaling, because it's like self-therapy. Yeah. So I would start doing that.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's, I think a lot of it is just about understanding that you're going to have emotions, understanding that the emotions are not tied to food. It's as simple as that. And just it's understanding and not coping with it, but dealing with things. Sometimes the emotion is having to have an awkward conversation with somebody. Sometimes it's about having an awkward conversation with yourself to call yourself out. You know, there's loads of ways. But yeah, deal with things. I think it's one of those, you know, I think we did a podcast, I think it was one we did with Shona actually, about this kind of stuff. And, you know, dealing with emotions is an uncomfortable thing. It's an uncomfortable situation and most people put it off. Like, you know, nobody likes having to deal with emotional stuff. That's life. But sometimes you have to. It's, you know, it's the same thing as, you know, the meme that I always talk about, the meme that I love, is about adulting yourself. You know, sometimes with emotions, you've got to do that. You've just got to face up to the fact that we're going to have emotions. They're going to show themselves. And sometimes you just need to lean into them and go, do you know what? This is why I'm feeling like this. But it's not the food isn't a link to the emotion. It's the first thing that you think of to try and get yourself away from that emotion. But sometimes you just need to face it up. It's uncomfortable. It's not fun. But, you know, it's something like journaling, writing down what it is that you're feeling and understanding it, so you can look back the next time and go, that's pretty much what's happening. You know, that's probably a good thing to start with.
Yeah, and that is what you're doing with food a lot of the time, is numbing that so you don't have to feel it. And there's two, like, really, we spoke about this briefly on the last podcast, but when you start to really get in touch with your emotions and you're not numbing emotions, because as Brené Brown says, you can't selectively numb emotions. So if you're numbing the negative, you won't feel the positive half as much. And once you start, like, allowing yourself to feel the negative and deal with the negative, life becomes so much better in general. Like, you feel the highs because you're allowing yourself to feel the lows as well, or you're accepting that the lows come. And I think that that's been huge for me personally, but, like, you see it in so many people, that you can't just choose which parts of your life you numb. So if you're avoiding something, then face it, because your whole life will become better. And then the second thing that, I can't remember where I read this, but it was something about whatever it is you're avoiding at the moment, that's the thing that you need to do. Like, whatever is it in your life that you're most trying to avoid, that's what's going to give you the most growth and freedom for the in the rest of your life. So, like, leaning into that, although it's freaking horrible and hard, and probably what you're trying to avoid doing, like, inevitably you have to face it at some point. And the sooner you do, the sooner that you can move on with your life and improve your life.
Yeah. I was watching a document. I don't know if you've watched any documentaries on Netflix recently. There's four or five that have popped up, called... What are they called? It's five documentaries, and they're kind of sport and background documentaries. So it's like, one of the ones I watched was about an ice hockey team that were owned by a gangster, which was quite interesting. But the second one was about something that happened in 2004, which was called Malice in the Palace, which was NBA basketballers got, there was a bit of a stramash on the court, and then the fans got involved. And one of the scapegoats, one of the players, because it was actually the fans that caused the whole issue. He said that. He goes, I was dealing with it. He was dealing with depression and anxiety and stuff at the time. And he was seeing a therapist. He goes, but because of the depression and everything like that, he goes, I couldn't see the highs. He goes, the lows and the highs, like, muted each other. He goes, I didn't see any of that. He goes, I was playing at the top of my game. I was smashing it, but I didn't see it because of the other side of it. And it's quite interesting, like, coming from, like, you know, obviously from a sort of high flying sportsman, where you think making millions, playing in the NBA, banging in shots all the time, that's not where I was going on that one.
Jesus.
But do you know what I mean? So, like, if you need to deal with the, and he said that, he goes, I avoided everything. He goes, if I dealt with things, he goes, I'd have probably seen the highs a lot better. And it's the same thing with this, you know, you're taking yourself back and try to take the pressure off yourself. Don't pressurize yourself. But also at the same point, you do need to face things up and understand that things do need to be dealt with.
I heard a great quote on another podcast the other day. It was the, oh my God, what's it called? A Need to Read podcast. And it was a quote from Lucy Lord. And it was something about, I'm going to butcher it, but it was essentially about, you know, like, we all have problems. Everyone. And actually, if you pile up all your problems and everyone put a pile of their problems out, you would likely take back your own. And I think that kind of puts things in perspective a little bit. Like, we all have these problems, and actually sometimes you think that yours are much worse than other people's, but if we all put them out there, the likelihood is you would take back your own problems. And a lot of the time, your biggest problems are really quite scarily closely connected to your biggest triumphs as well. And when I think about, like, the biggest failures in my life, I'm like, they would have never, like, they had to happen in order for the next thing to happen, which was a positive.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, deep. We always like finishing on a deep note, don't we?
Like getting into the emotional nitty gritty.
And then we're like, bye.
Ciao.
Okay. As
always, if you wouldn't mind popping on to where you get your podcasts and giving us a rating, it just makes other people they have the ability to see us so that we can impart our knowledge and our deep emotional connections to other people and help them as well.
Yes. And also, the way that works, apparently, I just found this out, is that the iTunes ranking is quite closely linked to the amount of reviews that podcasts are getting and the amount of good reviews that podcasts are getting. Yeah. So it would just massively help us, and we would be much, much obliged. Also, if you've enjoyed it, put it on Instagram, tag us at ESG Fitness, at Andy_ESG Fitness. We would love that. Okay, we will be back shortly to answer more questions.
Awesome. Bye.